Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here this week with co-host Russ Chianelli, and we're going to be talking about circadian rhythms. You probably think that's either a dance, or you think, no, that's to do with day and night and jet lag and things like that. Well, Russ and I are both night people, so we're not up and down 24 hours a day. But our guest today is Brian Zoltowski. He's a professor of
chemistry
at SMU, Southern Methodist University, down there in the Dallas area. Brian, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you're a chemist. You just told us that, but I don't like the audience to know that. So from now on, we won't talk about your background as a chemistry professor, but you're into circadian rhythms, and that's obviously very biological. So there's obviously been some interesting switches in your career goals. So let's go back to the beginning. Little Brian, when you were a little baby or a young man, what got you into a scientific career?
Really, I just always enjoyed playing with things. I mean, as kids, anything we see is something unique and interesting. And it's how we learn is finding something, playing with it, figuring out how it works so we can apply that to new things that we don't understand.
Well, sometimes the kids do dangerous things. Did you do any dangerous things?
That is exactly how I ended up getting into kind of science. One of the first things I remember being scientific is my grandma gave us this glassware that looked like flasks and bottles and different kind of fun things to play with in a science lab. So my brother and I, of course—
They were real laboratory glasses?
They were
glasses?
Not. No. They just looked like laboratory glasses, which is good enough for a kid.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, we started playing with them. We, of course, found random chemicals around the house. The ones we went to are in the cleaning room. So I highly disadvise actually ever going and mixing cleaning solutions together. It can be very dangerous. But for us, what it ended up doing is making a small explosion, which, of course, is fascinating to a kid, not quite as fascinating to the parents. But it just gave me this idea that, you know, we can actually take stuff that's just around us naturally, play with it, mix together, and transform it in completely different ways that we don't expect. And that just kind of sparked an interest and a curiosity that continues.
You know, I mean, that's interesting because nowadays, you know, kids with that imagination. I remember this young boy just recently that built his own clock, right? He was hauled before the principal and then the FBI and all sorts of people as a potential terrorist because he was a Muslim.
It's kind of unfortunate. I mean, as a kid, you're supposed to have fun and play.
Yeah.
You're supposed to be curious, do stupid things every once in a while.
Well,
and get hurt.
Like
you know, and I think we almost...
Yeah, there is something about parenthood, now a new book, I don't remember the author, but saying if you don't allow your kids to take risks, they really grow up poor.
Yeah. I mean, we got hurt all the time.
Yeah.
And it was part of life. And we played with things. We did some stupid things. And your parents were there to guide you in the right directions to make sure you didn't use that for nefarious purposes.
And you enjoyed it so much, you said, I've become an assistant professor and carry on doing those dangerous things and enjoyable things.
Along the line. Pretty much I just kept on following things that were interesting, things I like to play with.
Well, after the show, I'll tell you about when I was about 12, I got a kilogram of sodium.
Oh, did you go fishing?
Yeah, right. Okay, so the big topic I want to get to today is this business of circadian rhythms. So tell us, what does that mean? And then how did you move into it from being just a regular chemist?
So circadian rhythms are the natural 24-hour cycles we all have. We all get hungry at certain times of day. We go to sleep typically at the same times of day. And that's because we have our own biological clock that tells us what part of the 24-hour period that is the natural daylight cycles that we live in. And so circadian rhythms are that natural mechanism that we use to measure our 24-hour period. And, you know, I kind of got into an accident. Going in college, I actually studied something very far related from it, which was, you know, more towards physics than even chemistry. And part of that was I never slept. I was always basically a night owl. By default, because of where society is run, I had to be up in the mornings, but I was most functional in the evening. So I knew that my clock never worked. So I was kind of just fascinated with them in general, but never thought I would ever actually study them because I hated biology. And they seemed intrinsically a biology type of thing. And I was a mathematician more than anything.
You mean all those curly molecules and things like that?
Yeah. I mean, and memorizing a whole bunch of different, you know, plant genesis. I just was not interested in knowing all the Latin names of everything. And that seemed like what biology was to me. So I went into the chemistry and physics end, and I ended up studying something called nonlinear dynamics, which are the equivalent of circadian rhythms. They're natural oscillations that occur in different types of material, matter, nature in general. And I kept an interest in circadian rhythms, but figured there was no possible way to study it as a chemist. And I was fortunate when I went to Cornell for my PhD work that there was a guy that was a chemist by training, a physical chemist by of all things, who happened to study circadian rhythms. And, you know, it was maybe just dumb luck, but I was able to kind of get into it from the techniques I knew how to use and my knowledge and apply it to something that I never thought I'd get to work on.
So tell us then, what is the relationship between physical chemistry and this biological circadian rhythm? And where do the two intersect? Where's the Venn diagram overlap?
So it's one of the fascinating things. It's one, unfortunately, that we don't emphasize enough these days. We kind of get into our little, you know, cabinets of I'm a chemist, I'm a physicist, I'm a biologist. And reality is they're all the same field. They're all intersecting. And I was able to kind of take advantage of that with circadian rhythms because naturally they're driven by light. That's what we use as a cue for what time of day it is. That means there's photochemistry driving basically induction of morning and recognizing when evening begins. So there's that chemical element. Those chemical elements end up regulating a diverse array of different proteins that are in a biological circuit. Well, that means biology is involved because it's being regulated by the laws of biology. But ultimately, there's also this complex circuit design, which is really difficult to understand. And the only way we can look at the whole system together is with mathematics, which brings us into physics. So by default, all these different tools I had as far as mathematical modeling, a background in chemistry for the photochemistry, and while I never had any biological training and still don't to this day, but the ultimate goal is applying those chemistry principles and the physical principles to something in biology that we can all observe and relate to.
You know, there's so many fascinating questions about that too, because you could also include philosophy. How did these things evolve? The ones that slept all day died?
It's actually, I mean, ultimately that ends up being related to it. If you go back, circadian rhythms emerged 3.5 billion years ago. And what happened 3.5 billion years ago is our atmosphere changed. And there's what they call the great oxidation event, where all of a sudden our atmosphere on Earth had a lot of oxygen. And most people are familiar with the idea of reactive oxygen species being dangerous for causing cancer in people. And part of that reason is oxygen's extremely reactive. So all of a sudden we have oxygen in our atmosphere, organisms had to live around it, and that was dangerous. And it turns out if you combine light and oxygen with a lot of the metals that are around in biology, you create rampant reactive oxygen species that would kill the organisms. So they had to have a way to predict when light would be around to protect themselves from incoming damage. And that led to the onset, presumably, of circadian rhythms so that they weren't making these protective elements all the time, only when they needed them, which was when there was light.
What about people who or animals that live in polar regions? If I live in Tromsø, somewhere way up the top of Norway, or the Lapps, people like that, I mean, their whole biochemistry is different. I mean, because they, you know, it's dark all the time in the winter, or most of the time. How does that translate? Can we see genetic markers in people?
So that's a really tricky question and a very fascinating one. In theory, you'd think there would be. One of the benefits of circadian rhythms is that even in the absence of a cue, they'll be maintaining a 24-hour rhythm. So even in the absence of light, once it's been set to 24 hours, it should stay there. But many organisms—
But what's the trigger then that turns it on and off?
The trigger turning it on and off—
Time.
Is time, yeah. We just keep the 24-hour rhythm. Light is our way of resetting it in case we have something like jet lag.
So do you think that the animals and people up there, because I was up there in Alaska, and you know there you're in a restaurant at 11 o'clock at night and the sun is pouring through the window. Do you think that they've adapted to that? They have different rhythms?
They don't really adapt to it. You know, you'll find a lot of different things. Like I think they call it seasonal affective disorder, which people that live in those environments have mood issues, and suicides are more common in those environments. And part of it is because there is slight misregulation of the clock when you have continuous stimuli like light or a complete absence of light. You can get basically rhythms that eventually become offset and they're no longer functioning well. Fortunately, we eat on a rhythmic basis too, so that helps maintain it. but it can lead to a lot of different problems if our rhythms are off from the natural environment, which leads to disorders related to mood, disorders related to metabolism like diabetes, and these actually turn to be more common in the northern latitudes where you have misregulation of the clock.
The implication there is we've got several of these different rhythms within our body, one for digestion, one for sleep.
So in mammals like us, we're fairly complex. We have, you know, only special cells, basically our skin and through our eyes, that are able to perceive light. So we have multiple clocks all throughout our body to keep all the different cell types and all the different organs on the same 24-hour period. And the way we actually maintain that is there's a master clock in our brain. That master clock gets direct stimuli from our eyes, and that's basically where light input's coming in. So our eyes are sensing light. That tells our brain when morning is, and we can get a 24-hour rhythm in our brain. That sends cues to the rest of our body and tries to keep everything in phase with that clock. But our liver also has a very dominant clock. That one's set through feeding because we also eat in a rhythmic pattern. So what can happen is those two clocks become misaligned, and you see this most with people that have what they call shift work disorders.
So people who are blind from birth that absolutely have – presume, and I don't know this, but no sense of brightness, darkness, mm-hmm. and maybe I'm totally wrong there, but the liver functionality, eating, becomes the dominant one, and that's their cue.
It can be, but there are some people that actually are blind. They refer to the disorder as non-24, where they do not maintain normal circadian rhythms, and they'll sleep at the wrong times of day because they just don't know any better, and their brain is not sending them the right cues. And there's actually now pharmaceutical products that help tune the clock to help those people keep a 24-hour rhythm.
So, I mean, you just can't wake them up and I mean, a child, you know, at birth, if you know the child is going to be permanently blind for the rest of their life, produce stimulation like sound. Time to get up, you know, time to go to sleep because it's forced upon you. You won't train the brain.
You could, in theory, but, you know, I was trained to get up in mornings and go to bed in evenings. I teach at 3:30 in the afternoon. And there's a very good reason why I do that is because even though they tried to train me to get up in mornings, mm-hmm. I don't. So there are people like me that, you know, training doesn't work.
When I first came here, my chair said, "Do you want to teach in the summer?" I said, "Why would I do that?" He said, "Well, you earn more money." I said, "Oh, well, that doesn't sound so bad." Then he gave me a class at 7:30 mm-hmm. in the morning. And that was a stimulation for me to go out and get research funds.
Yes.
I mean, so I've got to say that was one of the most useful things that I first came across when I was here. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, here with Russ Chianelli and Brian Soltowski, professor of chemistry at Southern Methodist University, but an expert on circadian rhythms. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Brian Soltowski, Russ Chianelli, professor of chemistry at Southern Methodist University, an expert on circadian rhythms. And now let's get in, Brian, into the what you might call the photophysics of circadians, where you got in the first place. Mm-hmm. You're interested in light. You're interested in all those aspects of science. What contribution are you making, or what are you learning about circadian rhythms based upon your scientific knowledge?
So we've approached actually circadian rhythms in a bunch of different ways, all from the same standpoint of how the initial light cue to the organism drives physiological output, meaning something we can observe. We've studied basically insects. We've studied – now we're spending a lot of time in plants. We've studied mammals to some extent. Where mammals, a lot of times we don't look at because, like I was saying, it's very complex. We have all these different clocks, and there's not as direct of a cue between light and the organism. And the reason we want a cue between light and organism is it simplifies figuring out what's going on. We can actually trigger an initiation point. We can say, start now, by shining light on it, and look at how that cue drives everything downstream. So by focusing on actual photochemistry, we have great control over the time aspects of what's going on in the organism. And what our approach has been is to use something called structural biology. So photoreceptor is a protein. Proteins are made up of amino acids. They end up forming a very defined shape. And structural biology looks at trying to understand what that shape of the protein is, and how that shape enables it, one, to recognize light, and how that recognition of light is able to tell an organism what to do. So a great example of this that everybody's probably familiar with, anybody that's ever grown a plant in their house has put it near a window, and that plant will grow towards the light, and it'll bend towards it. And it doesn't matter how many times you just move the plant around and spin it, it's going to keep bending back towards light. That process is called phototropism. Phototropism is bending of a plant towards the light. It was originally discovered well over 100 years ago.
By whom?
By Darwin.
Darwin?
Yeah, Charles Darwin was the first person to write about it. And if we look at how that's working, ultimately it has to recognize that light input is coming in. And there is a protein called phototropin, named after the process of phototropism, that recognizes blue light, and it tells a plant to have differential growth patterns on the part that is away from the light and the part that's towards the light, and that causes it to bend towards it. So there are these great physiological cues that we can couple, something we can observe of a plant bending towards the light, and dial that back into the photoreceptors. So we've taken the same approach to circadian rhythms, where we take those photoreceptors, we figure out their structure, we figure out their chemistry, and we can link it step by step like an assembly line through the biological process of how that initial photon came in, activated the protein, and ultimately through all the different biological steps, how it caused circadian rhythms to occur. And from that, we've understood a lot about how we can manipulate and regulate circadian rhythms for our advantage.
So you've got a laboratory. You've
yes.
got lights that switch on and off. When the lights are off, it's dark, no windows. And so you're doing these experiments. Can you create plants that have a circadian rhythm that's just whatever time you choose? So that the old 24-hour of the natural plant is now supplanted by whatever you put in every 6 hours, every 12 hours, every 48 hours. I mean, can you do tricks like that?
So that's exactly what we've been doing now.
Oh.
Obviously, it's not completely published yet, but we...
the implication, I'd have read it if
yes.
it had been published.
But what we do is we study the chemistry well enough, and we actually have built mathematical models. So starting with actual chemistry using natural lighting conditions outside in nature, that with those light patterns, we can control the activity of the photoreceptor. We understand now to some extent how the biological circuits work, so we can understand how that light input manipulates the circuit, and then how that circuit is measuring, let's say, 24-hour periods or 18-hour periods, that we can potentially control the output. So what we've actually done now with plants is starting with just tuning chemistry. So we're tuning a photoreceptor, one molecule in an entire organism.
What about the wavelength? Is red light better than green light or something?
Blue light for circadian rhythms, mostly.
Blue?
Blue.
Okay.
It's because blue is most abundant during the middle of the day. But by tuning the blue light photoreceptors, we now have some strains of plants that will have a 16-hour photoperiod.
Okay.
And other ones that have – the longest we've done is 32.
So that leads to the next question then. If you've got a plant that is important for food within the world system, wheat, I don't know, you'd name whatever it is, can you make their circadian rhythms every 6 hours and then get several crops in a year, right? I mean, that is, you're speeding the whole process up, right? I mean, I don't know how that would work, but I mean, it seems if you're making the plant behave in a sort
of
manner.
Well, there are other cases
quicker.
Where crops like that, the lights are grown 24 hours a day with the lights on all the time.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, most plants, and this is one of the reasons we study the clocks in plants, crop output is largest when the clock from nature is aligned with the clock of the organism. So in theory, maybe we could do something like that.
But you've manipulated the clock of the organism.
Yes.
So therefore, the easiest part is what comes next.
Yes.
You manipulating the environment so that this poor plant is just chugging along at a fantastic rate.
One of the negatives from that is right now, which would cause basically not to be quite as useful, is in plants, and this gets back to what the question was earlier about people that live in northern latitudes. Well, plants do the same thing. And plants are very, you know, latitudinally oriented. And there's something in them called photoperiodism, which is measuring not a 24-hour period, but maintaining a clock for the spring, fall, winter. So they know what time of year it is. And they use basically that photoperiodic clock to know when to flower. So basically when you're going to produce fruit, which when we're talking about agricultural purposes,
yes,
we want the fruiting bodies most often.
But, I mean, the question I have is that plants don't have to rest, because I know people who have grown important plants where they leave the lights on all the time.
Yep. And, I mean, you actually do get bigger crops in the northern latitudes. Like you can get heads of lettuce that, you know, are like watermelon-sized in Canada.
Well, we saw this was pumpkin contest with 2,000-pound pumpkins.
Yeah. I mean, what the problem, though, is there's this coupling between the circadian clock and the photoperiodic clock. So we can tune the circadian window of between, you know, 16 hours and 32 hours. But we unfortunately also end up tuning the photoperiodic clock, and it causes a delay in flowering. Okay. So they don't flower as early. So right now what we're really studying is what that coupling between those two clock mechanisms are. So we can do things like you're saying, of can we improve crop yield if we can only affect one, not the other?
All right.
And it, unfortunately, organisms have lived for a lot longer than I've been studying them. And they've had a lot of time to make sure that they're protected from these changes in the environment.
But I think it's interesting. Plants don't have to rest, and we do.
Tell us about what the plants are that you're actually looking at.
So
would we recognize one? Roses or alfalfa or I don't know.
Not really. I mean, unfortunately, when we're talking about doing biological research, a lot of times we work with model organisms. So a model organism for mammals is a mouse.
Okay.
You know, model organism for fungal species is Neurospora. It's a bread mold.
Right.
For plants, it's called a Rhabdopsis. Rhabdopsis thaliana.
Rhabdopsis.
Yes.
What does it look like? Is it a weed?
It's a weed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Weeds seem to be much more, you know, capable of doing things.
Yes.
Than regular plants. Regular plants are needy creatures.
Yeah.
But I would have said a model would be something like algae. Simpler.
Well, there are models for algae, but the biology is different between basically the plant and the algae. So if you really want to understand flowering time and reproduction, you really need to look in a plant.
So with animals, you can get knockout mice and things like that. We manipulate the genome, all right, and so we can make the mouse much more prone to this disease or not prone to that disease. Same thing with this Rhabdopsis or whatever it was called. I mean, did they have knockout Rhabdopsis or Rhabdopsis?
That's actually exactly why they use a Rhabdopsis as a model. We don't really care about manipulating the weed, so to speak, but if we want to do genetics, which is what you're referring to, of knocking out a gene, it has to be genetically tractable, meaning we have to be able to do genetics in it. And it turns out it's really easy to do genetics in a Rhabdopsis. It's not easy to necessarily to do it in other species. Also, if we want to measure get a lot of data, things that grow fast are better. So if we're studying a crop that has a one-year cycle, we can study it once a year. If we study something that grows in 6 weeks, we have a lot more opportunity. We can do basically 8.5, you know, studies each year. So
does that mean that your graduate students can get PhDs in, you know, 1/5 of the time? Or
oh, we would never allow that.
No, totally.
We need to keep them around.
And what sort of people find it of interest, and what do they do after they've got their higher degrees in this area of science?
They can go anywhere.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things people don't ever understand about scientists is we're pretty normal people. You know, through my training, I've worked in a lot of different areas. When I finished up my PhD, I thought about going into business consulting, and I had opportunities there. So I could have went into a strictly business-type environment.
Well, I think the bottom line, though, is what you started off in the beginning, is that really, if you're a good scientist, you are interdisciplinary.
Yeah, and you're also good at problem-solving. You look at things around you, realize something's odd, and your natural inclination, what you've been trained to do, is figure out why it's odd. And a lot of different types of career paths like that mentality of that you're trained to basically problem solve. So once you have a training in the sciences, you know, my grad students can go anywhere. Some of them will stay in science.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them will go into teaching. Some of them will go into business. Some of them might go into art.
I know in certain universities in England, PhD in chemistry is sort of the entry requirement for getting to the City of London and just spending the rest of their lives dealing with finances, right? I mean, it had nothing to do with the chemistry or physics or so, but just to do with the mindset, the way they approach an issue.
Yeah. I mean, I tell my students this, I teach freshman chemistry a lot, so I teach people in the very beginning stages of their career where all of them think they want to be a doctor and that they think they are going to be a doctor. And I tell them, you know, this, you're going to change. You know, you're 18 years old, your
interest
will change.
I had the same discussion with him. I said, why do you want to be a doctor? You want to help people, or did your grandmother tell you that's what you have to do?
Yeah. And what they end up finding is, you know, they like different things. And I say what the important part is, and the reason you're taking general chemistry, is we're going to teach you how to problem solve. You're not going to know how to do the problem. There is not going to be some formula you just plug everything into. You're going to have to figure out how to take different complex ideas and merge them into some type of synthesis to get one result out. And that's what life is. It's problem solving. 99% of the time, I'm going to fail at what I do in a lab. But the 1% of the time it works,
wow,
we can make some great discoveries. And failure is important. I can go through list after list of stories of Nobel Prize winners that basically stumbled upon their result on accident.
You don't have to go to Nobel Prize winners. Look around the table.
That's true.
I mean, failure. And the earlier you get a taste of failure, I think the better. I mean, you know, quite often you have and so do you at SMU, a lot of undergraduates doing research as part of a research team. And, you know, if they're too lucky, they begin to think this is the way it is.
But, I mean, I tell my first-year students, you know, one of the questions when they want to work in my research lab that I ask them for their interview is, tell me the last time you failed. And what you see is a lot of them will want to come up with the answer of like, oh, I don't fail.
Failure? How do you spell that?
Yeah. And, you know, that's the exact wrong answer. Because when you have people that have never failed at anything in their life, uh-huh. when they do fail at it, it's so foreign to them that it's difficult to overcome. I want the person that's failed a million times and is somehow still there in front of me wanting to do the research. Because that means they've overcome every one of those failures to get to the point that they're currently at.
Well, we failed the audience. We've come to the end of a science studio. There are no more minutes left, you know. No matter what our circadian rhythms, we've run out of time. So, Brian Zeltowski, SMU, circadian rhythm man, thank you so much for being here on Science Studio. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
Take care.